which was considerably more like it. The smart people were still afraid of her. That thought was more nourishing than the lamb. As she reached for the screen, the ship shifted under her, gravity pulling her slightly to the side. She put her hand on the desk. The curry and the remnants of gin churned her gut.
"Were we expecting that?"
she shouted.
"Yes, ma'am,"
Kotyar called from the next room. "Scheduled course correction."
"Never happens at the fucking office," she said.
And Michael John appeared on her screen. He looked mildly confused, but that could have been just the angle of his face. She felt a sick dread. For a moment, the Arbogast floated before her again, coming apart. Without intending it, she paused the feed. Something in the back of her mind wanted to turn away, not to know. It wasn't hard to understand how Ehrenreich and Nguyen and their cabal would turn their backs on Venus, on the alien chaos that was becoming order and more than order. She felt it too, the atavistic fear lurking at the back of her mind. How much easier to turn to the old games, the old patterns, the history of warfare and conflict, deception and death. For all its horror, it was familiar. It was known. As a girl, she'd seen a film about a man who saw the face of God. For the first hour of the film, he had gone through the drab life of someone living on basic on the coast of southern Africa. When he saw God, the film switched to 10 minutes of the man wailing, then another hour of slowly building himself back up to do the same idiot life he'd had at the beginning. Avasarala had hated it. Now, though, she almost understood. Turning away was natural. Even if it was moronic and self-destructive and empty, it was natural. War, slaughter, death. All the violence that Ehrenreich and his men, and she felt certain they were almost all of the men, were embracing, they were drawn to because it was comforting. And they were scared. Well, so was she. "Pussies," she said, and restarted the playback. "Venus can think," Michael John said instead of hello or any other social pleasantry. "I've had the signal analysis team running the data we saw from the network of water and electrical currents, and we found a model. It's only about a 60% correlation, but I'm comfortable putting that above chance. It's got different anatomy, of course, but its functional structure is most like a cetacean doing spatial reasoning problems. I mean, there's still the problem of the explanatory gap, and I can't help with that part. But with what we've seen, I'm fairly sure that the patterns we saw were it thinking. They were the actual thoughts, like neurons firing off." He looked into the camera as if expecting her to answer, and then looked mildly disappointed when she didn't. "I thought you'd want to know," he said, and ended the recording. Before she could formulate a response, a new message from Souther appeared. She opened it with a sense of gratitude and relief that she was slightly ashamed of.
"Christian," he said, "we have a problem. You should check the force assignments on Ganymede and let me know if we're seeing the same things."
Avasarala frowned. The lag now was over 28 minutes. She put in a standard request, expedited it, and stood up. Her back was a solid knot. She walked to the common area of the suite. Bobby, Kotyar, and three other men were sitting in a circle, the deck of cards distributed among them. Poker. Avasarala walked toward them, rolling through the hips where movement hurt. Something about lower gravity made her joints ache. She lowered herself to Bobby's side.
"Next hand, you can deal me in," she said.
The order had come from Nguyen, and at first glance it made no sense at all. 6 UN destroyers had been ordered off the Ganymede patrol, sent out at high burn on a course that seemed to lead, essentially, to nowhere. Initial reports showed that after a decent period of wondering what the fuck,
A similar detachment of Martian ships matched course. Nguyen was up to something, and she didn't have the first clue what it could be. But Souther had sent it and thought she would see something. It took another hour to find it. Holden's Rosinante had departed Tycho Station on a gentle burn for the Jovian system. He might have filed a flight plan with the OPA, but he hadn't informed Earth or Mars of anything, which meant Nguyen was watching him, too. They weren't just scared. They were going to kill him. Avasarala sat quietly for a long moment before she stood up and went back toward the game. Kotyar and Bobby were at the end of a high-stakes round, which meant the pile of little bits of chocolate candy they were using for chips was almost 5 centimeters deep. "Mr. Kotyar," Avasarala said. "Sergeant Draper, with me, please." The cards all vanished. The men looked at each other nervously as she walked back into her bedroom. She closed the door behind them carefully. It didn't even click. "I'm about to do something that may pull a trigger," she said. "If I do this, the complexion of our situation may change." Kotyar and Bobby exchanged looks. "I have some things I'd like to get out of storage," Bobby said. "I'll brief the men," Kotyar said. 10 minutes. The lag between the Guanxi Yin and the Rosinante was still too long for conversation, but it was less than it took to get a message back to Earth. The sense of being so far from home left her a little lightheaded. Kotyar stepped into the room and nodded once. Avasarala opened her terminal and requested a tight beam connection. She gave the transponder code for the Rosinante. Less than a minute later, the connection came back refused. She smiled to herself and opened a channel to ops. "This is Assistant Undersecretary Avasarala," she said, as if there were anyone else on board who it might be. "What the fuck is wrong with your tight beam?" "I apologize, Madam Secretary," a young man with bright blue eyes and close-cut blonde hair said. "That communication channel isn't available right now." "Why the fuck isn't it available?" "It's not available, ma'am." "Fine. I didn't want to do this on the radio, but I can broadcast if I have to." "I'm afraid that won't be possible," the boy said. Avasarala took a long breath and let it out through her teeth. "Put the captain on," she said. A moment later, the image jumped. The captain was a thin-faced man with the brown eyes of an Irish setter. The set of his mouth and his bloodless lips told her that he knew what was coming, at least an outline. For a moment, she just looked into the camera. It was a trick she'd learned when she'd just started off. Looking at the screen image let the other person feel they were being seen. Looking into the tiny black pinpoint of the lens itself left them feeling stared down. "Captain, I have a high-priority message I need to send." "I am very sorry. We're having technical difficulties with the communication array." "Do you have a backup system? A shuttle we can power up? Anything?"
"Not at this time."
"You're lying to me," she said. Then, when he didn't answer, "I am making an official request that this yacht engage its emergency beacon and change course to the nearest aid."
"I'm not going to be able to do that, ma'am. If you will just be patient, we'll get you to Ganymede safe and in one piece. I'm sure any repairs we need can be done there."
Avasarala leaned close to the terminal. "I can come up there and we can have this conversation personally," she said. "Captain, you know the laws as well as I do. Turn on the beacon or give me communications access."
"Ma'am, you are the guest of Jules-Pierre Mao, and I respect that. But Mr. Mao is the owner of this vessel, and I answer to him."
"No, then.
I'm very sorry."
"You're making a mistake, shithead," Avasarala said, and dropped the connection. Bobby came into the room. Her face was bright, and there was a hunger about her, like a running dog straining at the leash. Gravity shifted a degree, A course correction, but not a change.
How'd it go? Bobby asked.
I'm declaring this vessel in violation of laws and standards, Avasarala said. Kotya, you're witness to that.
As you say, ma'am.
All right, then. Bobby, get me control of this fucking ship.
Chapter 38. Bobby.
What else do you need from us? Kotyar asked.
Two of his people were moving the big crate marked formal wear into Avasarala's room. They were using a large furniture dolly and grunting with effort. Even in the gentle quarter G of the Guanxi Yin's thrust, Bobby's armor weighed over 100 kilos.
We're sure this room isn't under surveillance? Bobby said.
This is going to work a lot better if they have no idea what's about to happen.
Kotyar shrugged.
It has no functioning eavesdropping devices I've been able to detect.
Okay then, Bobby said, rapping on the fiberglass crate with her knuckle. Open it up.
Kotyar tapped something on his hand terminal and the crate's locks opened with a sharp click. Bobby yanked the opened panel off and leaned it against the wall. Inside the crate, suspended in a web of elastic bands, was her suit.
Kotyar whistled.
A Goliath III? Can't believe they let you keep it.
Bobby removed the helmet and put it on the bed, then began pulling the various other pieces out of the webbing and setting them on the floor.
They gave it to your tech guys to verify some video stored in the suit. When Avasarala tracked it down, it was in a closet collecting dust. No one seemed to care when she took it.
She pulled out the suit's right arm. She hadn't expected them to get her any of the 2mm ammo the suit's integrated gun used, but was surprised to find that they'd completely removed the gun from the housing. It made sense to remove all the weapons before handing the suit off to a bunch of civilians, but it still annoyed her.
Shit, she said. Won't be shooting anyone, I guess.
If you did, Kotyar said with a smile, would the bullets even slow down as they went through both of the ship's hulls and let all the air out?
Nope, Bobby said, laying the last piece of the suit on the floor, then pulling out the tools necessary to put it all back together again.
But that might be a point in my favor. The gun on this rig is designed to shoot through other people wearing comparable armor. Anything that will shoot through my suit here will probably also hold a ship, which means none of the security personnel on this vessel will have weapons capable of penetrating your armor.
Kotyar finished.
As you say. How many of my people will you want with you?
None, Bobby said, attaching the fresh battery pack Avasarala's techs had provided to the back of the armor and getting a lovely green, fully charged light from the panel. Once I get started, the obvious counterplay will be to grab the undersecretary and hold her hostage. Preventing that is your job.
Kotyar smiled again. There was no humor in it.
As you say.
It took Bobby just under 3 hours to assemble and field prep her suit. It should have taken only 2, but she forgave herself the extra hour by remembering that she was out of practice. The closer the suit got to completion, the tighter the knot in her stomach grew. Some of it was the natural tension that came before combat, and her time in the Marines had taught her to use it. To let the stress force her to recheck everything 3 times. Once she was in the thick of it, it would be too late. But deep down, Bobby knew that the possibility of violence wasn't the only thing twisting up her insides. It was impossible to forget what had happened the last time she'd worn this suit. The red enamel of her Martian camouflage was pitted and scraped from the exploding monster, and her high-speed skid across Ganymede's ice. A tiny bit of fluid leakage on the knee reminded her of Private Hillman, Hilly, her friend. Wiping off the helmet's faceplate made her think of the last time she'd spoken to Lieutenant Givens, her CO, just before the monster had ripped him in 2. When the suit was finished and lying on the floor, opened up and waiting for her to climb inside, she felt a shudder run up her spine.
For the first time ever, the inside looked small, sepulchral.
No, she said to no one but herself. No?
Kotyar asked, sitting on the floor next to her, holding the tools he thought she might need next. He'd been so quiet during the assembly procedure, she'd sort of forgotten he was there.
I'm not afraid of putting this back on, she said.
Ah,
Kotyar replied with a nod, then put the tools into the toolbox.
As you say.
Bobby pushed herself to her feet and yanked the black unitard she wore under the armor out of the crate. Without thinking about it, she stripped down to her panties and pulled the skin-tight garment on. She was pulling the wire leads out of her armor and connecting them to the various sensors on the bodysuit when she noticed that Kotyar had turned his back to her and that his usually light brown neck was turning beet red.
Oh, she said. Sorry. I've stripped down and put this on in front of my squaddies so many times I don't even think about it anymore.
No reason to apologize, Kotyar said without turning around. I was only taken by surprise.
He risked a peek over his left shoulder, and when he saw that she was fully covered by the bodysuit, he turned back to help her wire it up to the armor.
You are, he said, then paused for a beat, lovely.
It was her turn to blush.
Aren't you married?
Bobby asked with a grin, happy for the distraction. The simple humanity in discomfort with mating signals made the monster in her head seem very far away.
Yes,
Kotyar replied, attaching the final lead to a sensor at the small of her back.
Very, but I'm not blind.
Thank you, Bobby said, and gave him a friendly pat on the shoulder. After a few moments' struggle with the tight spaces, she sat down into the suit's open chest and slid down until her legs and arms were fully inside.
Button me up.
Kotyar sealed up the chest as she'd shown him, then put the helmet on her and locked it in place. Inside the suit, her HUD flashed through the boot routine. A gentle, almost subliminal hum surrounded her. She activated the array of micromotors and pumps that powered the exomusculature, and then sat up. Kotyar was looking at her, his face a question. Bobby turned on the external speaker and said,
Yeah, it all looks good in here. Green across the board.
She pushed herself to her feet effortlessly and felt the old sensation of barely restrained power running through her limbs. She knew if she pushed off hard with her legs, she'd hit the ceiling with enough force to severely damage it. A sudden motion of her arm could hurl the heavy four-poster bed across the room or shatter Kotyar's spine. It made her move with the deliberate gentleness of long training. Kotyar reached under his jacket and pulled out a sleek black pistol of the slug-throwing variety. Bobby knew the security team had loaded them with high-impact plastic rounds, guaranteed not to knock holes in the ship. It was the same kind of round Mao's security team would be using. He started to hold it out to her, but then looked at the thickness of her armored fingers and at the much smaller opening of the trigger guard, and shrugged apologetically.
I won't need it, she said. Her voice sounded harsh, metallic, inhuman.
Kotyar smiled again.
As you say.
Bobby punched the button to call the keel elevator, then walked back and forth in the lounge, letting her reflexes get used to her armor. There was a nanosecond delay between attempting to move a limb and having the armor react. It made walking around feel vaguely dreamlike, as if the act of wanting to move your limbs and the moving of the limbs themselves were separate events. Hours of training and use had mostly overcome the sensation when Bobby wore her armor, but it always took a few minutes of moving around to get past the oddness of it. Avasarala walked into the lounge from the room they were using as the communications center and sat down at the bar. She poured herself a stiff shot of gin, then squeezed a piece of lime into it almost as an afterthought. The old lady had been drinking a lot more lately, but it wasn't Bobby's place to point it out. Maybe it was helping her sleep. When the elevator didn't arrive after several minutes, she thumped over to the panel and hit the button a few more times. A small display said, "Out of service."
"Damn," Bobby said to herself. "They really are kidnapping us."
She'd left the external speakers on, and the harsh voice coming out of her suit echoed around the room. Avasarala didn't look up from her drink, but said, "Remember what I said."
"Huh?" Bobby said, not paying attention.
She climbed awkwardly up the crew ladder to the deck hatch above her and hit the button. The hatch slid open. That meant that everyone was still pretending that this wasn't a kidnapping. They could explain away the elevator. Explaining why the Undersecretary was locked out of the rest of the ship would be harder. Maybe they figured a woman in her 70s would be reluctant to climb around the ship on ladders, so killing the lift was good enough. They might have been right. Avasarala certainly didn't look like she was up to a 200-foot climb, even in low gravity.
"None of these people were on Ganymede," Avasarala said.
"Okay," Bobby replied to the seeming non sequitur.
"You won't be able to kill enough of them to bring your platoon back,"
Avasarala finished, tossing off the last of her gin, then pushing away from the bar and heading off to her room. Bobby didn't reply. She pulled herself up to the next deck and let the hatch slide shut behind her. The armor had been designed for exactly this sort of mission. The original Goliath-class scout suits had been built for marine boarding parties in ship-to-ship engagements. That meant they were designed for maximum maneuverability in tight spaces. No matter how good the armor was, it was useless if the soldier wearing it couldn't climb ladders, slip through human-sized hatches, and maneuver gracefully in microgravity. Bobby climbed the ladder to the next deck hatch and hit the button. The console responded with a red warning light. A few moments of looking at the menus revealed why. They'd parked the crew elevator just above the hatch and then disabled it, creating a barricade. And that meant they knew something was up. Bobby looked around the room she was in, another relaxation lounge, nearly identical to the one she'd just left, until she found the likeliest place for them to have hidden their cameras. She waved.
"This won't stop me, guys."
She climbed back down and went into the luxurious bathroom space. On a ship this nice, it couldn't properly be called the head. A few moments' probing found the fairly well-hidden bulkhead service hatch. It was locked. Bobby tore it off the wall. On the other side were a tangle of piping and a narrow corridor barely large enough to stuff her armor into. She climbed in and pulled herself along the pipes for two decks, then kicked the service hatch into the room and climbed in. The compartment turned out to be a secondary galley, with a bank of stoves and ovens along one wall, several refrigeration units, and lots of counter space, all in gleaming stainless steel. Her suit warned her that she was being targeted, and changed the HUD so that the normally invisible infrared beams aimed at her became faint red lines. Half a dozen were painting her chest, all coming from compact black weapons held by Mao Quick security personnel at the other end of the room. Bobby stood up. To their credit, the security goons didn't back up. Her HUD ran through the weapons database and informed her that the men were armed with 5mm submachine guns with a standard ammo capacity of 300 rounds and a cyclic rate of 10 rounds per second. Unless they were using high-explosive armor-piercing rounds, unlikely with the ship's hull right behind her, the suit rated their danger level as low. Bobby made sure her external speakers were still on and said, "Okay, fellas, let's..." They opened fire. For one long second, the entire galley was in chaos. High-impact plastic rounds bounced off her armor, deflected off the bulkheads, and skipped around the room. They blew apart containers of dried goods, hurled pots and pans off their magnetic hooks, and flung smaller utensils into the air in a cloud of stainless steel and plastic shards. One round took a particularly unlucky bounce and hit one of the security guards in the center of his nose, punching a hole into his head and dropping him to the floor with an almost comic look of surprise on his face. Before 2 seconds could tick by, Bobby was in motion, launching herself across the steel island in the center of the room and plowing into all 5 remaining guards with her arms outstretched, like a football player going in for a tackle. They were hurled against the far bulkhead with a meaty thud, then slumped to the ground, motionless. Her suit started to put up life sign indicators on her HUD for them, but she shut it off without looking. She didn't want to know. One of the men stirred, then started to raise his gun. Bobby gently shoved him, and he flew across the room to crumple against the far bulkhead. He didn't move again. She glanced around the room, looking for cameras. She couldn't find one, but hoped it was there anyway. If they'd seen this, maybe they wouldn't throw any more of their people at her. At the keel ladder, she'd discovered that they'd blocked the elevator by jamming the floor hatch open with a crowbar. Basic ship safety protocols wouldn't allow the elevator to move to another deck unless the deck above was sealed. Bobby yanked out the crowbar and threw it across the room, then hit the call button. The lift climbed up the ladder shaft to her level and stopped. She jumped on and hit the button that would take her to the bridge, 8 decks up. 8 more pressure hatches. 8 more possible ambushes. She tightened her hands into fists until the knuckles stretched painfully inside her gauntlets. Bring it. 3 decks up, the elevator stopped, the panel informing her that all the pressure hatches between her and the bridge had been overridden and forced open. They were willing to risk a hole in the ship emptying out half the ship's air rather than let her up to the bridge. It was sort of gratifying to be scarier than sudden decompression. She climbed off the lift onto a deck that appeared to be mostly crew quarters, though it must have been evacuated. There wasn't a soul in sight. A quick tour revealed 12 small crew cabins and 2 bathrooms that could reasonably be called heads. No gold plating on the fixtures for the crew. No open bar. No 24-hour-a-day food service. Looking at the fairly Spartan living conditions of the average crew member on the Guanxi Yin brought home Avasarala's last words to her. These were just sailors. None of them deserved to die for what had happened on Ganymede. Bobby found herself glad she didn't have a gun. She found another access hatch in the head and tore it open. But to her surprise, the service corridor ended just a few feet above her head. Something in the structure of the ship was cutting her off. Having never seen the Guanxi Yin from the outside, she had no idea what it might be. But she needed to get another 5 decks up, and she wasn't about to let this stop her. A 10-minute search turned up a service hatch through the outer hull. She'd torn off 2 inner hull hatches on 2 different decks, so if she got it open, those 2 decks would lose their air. But the central ladder corridor was sealed at Avasarala's deck, so her people would be fine. And the whole reason she was doing this was the sealed hatch to the upper decks, which seemed to be where most of the crew was. She thought about the 6 men down in the galley and felt a pang. Sure, they'd shot first, but if any of them were still alive, she had no desire to asphyxiate them in their sleep. It turned out not to be a problem. The hatch led into a small airlock chamber about the size of a closet. A minute later, it had cycled through, and she climbed out onto the outer hull of the ship. Triple-hulled. Of course. The Lord of the Mao Quick Empire wasn't going to trust his expensive skin to anything that wasn't the safest humans could build. And the ostentatious design of the ship extended to her outer hull as well. While most military ships were painted a flat black that made them hard to spot visually in space, most civilian ships either were left in unpainted gray or were painted in basic corporate colors. The Guanxi Yin had a mural painted on it in vivid colors. Bobby was too close to see what it was, but under her feet were what appeared to be grass and the hoof of a giant horse. Mao had the hull of his ship painted with a mural that included horses and grass, when almost no one would ever see it. Bobby made sure her boot and glove mags were set strong enough to handle the quarter-G thrust the ship was still under, and started climbing up the side. She quickly reached the spot where the dead end between the hulls began, and saw that it was an empty shuttle bay. If only Avasarala had let her do this before Mao had run off with the shuttle. Triple hulls, Bobby thought. Maximum redundancy. On a hunch, she crawled across the ship to the other side. Sure enough, there was a second shuttle bay. But the ship in it wasn't a standard short-flight shuttle. It was long and sleek, with an engine housing twice as large as that of a normal ship its size. Written in proud letters across the bow of the ship was the name Razorback, a racing pinnace. Bobby crawled back around to the empty cargo bay and used the airlock there to enter the ship. The military override codes her suit sent to the locked door worked, to her surprise. The airlock led to the deck just below the bridge, the one used for shuttle supply storage and maintenance. The center of the deck was taken up by a large machine shop. Standing in it were the captain of the Guanxi Yin and his senior staff. There were no security personnel or weapons in sight. The captain tapped his ear in an ancient can-you-hear-me gesture. Bobby nodded one fist at him, then turned the external speakers back on and said, "Yes." "We are not military personnel," the captain said. "We can't defend ourselves from military hardware. But I'm not going to turn this vessel over to you without knowing your intentions. My XO is on the deck above us, prepared to scuttle the ship if we can't come to terms." Bobby smiled at him, though she didn't know if he could see it through her helmet. "You've illegally detained a high-level member of the UN government. Acting in my role as a member of the security team, I have come to demand that you deliver her immediately to the port of her choosing at best possible speed." She shrugged with her hands in the belter way. "Or you can blow yourselves up. Seems like a drastic overreaction to having to give the Undersecretary her radio privileges back." The captain nodded and relaxed visibly. Whatever happened next, it wasn't like he had any choice. And since he didn't have any choice, he didn't have any responsibility. "We were following orders. You'll note that in the log when you take command." "I'll see that she knows." The captain nodded again. "Then the ship is yours." Bobby opened her radio link to Kotyar. "We win. Put Her Majesty on, will you?" While she waited for Avasarala, Bobby said to the captain, "There are 6 injured security people down below. Get a medical team down there." "Bobby," Avasarala said over the radio. "The ship is yours, madam." "Great. Tell the captain we need to make best possible speed to intercept Holden. We're getting to him before Nguyen does." This is a pleasure yacht. It's built to run at low G for comfort. I'd bet it can do a full G if it needs to, but I doubt it does much more than that." "Admiral Nguyen is about to kill everyone that actually might know what the fuck is going on." Avasarala didn't quite yell. "We don't have time to cruise around like we're trying to pick up fucking rent, boys."